Verses I made once, glowing with content. Tearful, alas, sad songs must I begin. See how the muses, grief-torn, bid me write, and with unfeigned tears these elegies drench my face. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. Those words were written by Boethius, and he had good reason to be grief-torn and to drench his face with unfeigned tears. A successful politician, he was accused of treason in AD 523 and executed a year later. The verse I read was written while in prison, awaiting what he knew would be a painful and awful death. It is the beginning of his most famous work, The Consolation of Philosophy, which I thought we'd consider, given that we've just talked about Boethius on music a few weeks ago. As Boethius laments, Lady Philosophy appears to him. She casts out the lamenting muses and begins what she refers to as Boethius's cure. Dr. Jason Baxter has been teaching The Consolation of Philosophy for some years now, and he's our guest on this edition of the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Baxter, Boethius was in prison awaiting death, feeling a great deal of self-pity and composing laments. Then along comes Lady Philosophy. Tell us what goes on between the two of them.
They have a lengthy exchange, which lasts what Boethius divides up into five books. There's some scholarly speculation that there might have been more, and that it could have continued on. Some scholars even like to think, could it have turned into a consolation of theology by the end of it? And so it's very interesting. But over the course of five books, they have a conversation. And Lady Philosophy begins by what she calls the sort of lighter treatments. She just wants to stop the bleeding. You know, I tell my students, this is the tourniquet, right? This is, you can't operate on the patient in the backcountry, but you can. You can stop the, you know, stop the bleeding from the open wound. And so the books one and two are that, in which she gives these kind of lighter remedies to help him sort of unclench the grasp of his fingers on the worldly goods that he thought he was entitled to. And then once he's begun to sort of warm up, loosen up, begin to sort of respond to these initial arguments, then each book gets successively more difficult, from three and then to four and to five, so that in three you have a discussion of how each creature pursues the good. And then in four you have this extraordinarily difficult conversation on the difference between fate and providence. And it ends with book five, which is concerned with a distinction between what he calls perpetuity and eternity. And so it gets more and more difficult, but she has to initially calm the inflammation that the pain he's experiencing because these things that he so desperately wanted, which he thought were his good, have been ripped away from him.
Well, she calls his condition a sickness, and he needs a cure. Why a sickness and a cure? Doesn't he just need a change of mind?
I love that question. Yeah, I mean, she calls it, if I remember correctly, she calls it a letargo. Like a lethargy. It's a kind of deep despair. I've always seen this as playing out what we all know from experience, that there's a huge difference between knowing what sort of things I ought to believe and then actually longing for them with my heart and gripping onto them with my will. So I think that's really what's going on, is that, you know, Boethius is a well-trained philosopher, but he has this personal crisis in which he begins to wonder, I guess interesting. We would doubt if there were a God, but he doesn't. He knows there's a God. That's too obvious in the pre-modern world to doubt. But he begins to doubt whether or not this God cares for anything on earth, or this earth is just completely messed up. And he has some, I think, kind of cool Cormac McCarthy moments in which he sort of looks in the world like McCarthy looks in the world in Blood Meridian or The Road, and just is just nauseated by it. And it's hard to see that a caring providential God is at work for the benefit of his creatures in that type of landscape.
Well, book two, He, Lady Philosophy and Boethius spent a good deal of time discussing fortune and the wheel of fortune. How did Boethius and Lady Philosophy understand fortune, good fortune and bad fortune?
Right. Well, Boethius watched a lot of daytime television, and he loved Pat Sajak and Vanna White. And so he got the idea from them. I mean, they've been around for a long time. So, but
the Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah. The Wheel of Fortune and Pat Sajak. Yeah. So Boethius has this idea, which the medieval commentators love to illustrate, and they illustrate it with a turning of a wheel, which everyone knows moves faster on the periphery than it does on the inside, and it moves rapidly on the outside. So it's a very, very short trip. And on your way up, the medieval illustrators have pictures of kings who say, "I will rule." And then on the very top, they are proudly seated in a throne saying, "I rule, rego." And then as they tumble down, they say, "I have ruled." And these illustrations over the course of centuries get more and more dramatic, so that by the end, it's kind of like a demonic skeleton with a sword. And this is very Northern European, very German. Swinging the wheel as fast as he possibly can so that your moment at top is infinitesimally small, even though it's what you've been waiting your whole life for. So this is sort of Boethius's Lady Philosophy's consolation. What did you think? Of course, you're lucky, she says, because you right now understand the nature of the world. You understand the nature of fortune. She's not presenting to you a false front. You know that she constantly is shifting goods and gifts and that she's completely whimsical. So for a brief moment, you actually have clarity to see things how they are, and you should consider yourself, oh, Boethius, fortunate.
Now, Dante talks about fortune as well, doesn't he?
He does, yes.
In the same vein?
Yes. Virgil gives a very patronizing, avuncular speech. I think it's in Inferno 6, in which he reminds Dante what he knew quite well and everyone knew it quite well in the Middle Ages. And in fact, I've recently discovered that Lewis uses the scene from book 2 of The Consolation as underlying his own essay on living in an atomic age.
C.S. Lewis.
Yes, it's the same argument of the Wheel of Fortune, in which he says, we are temporarily seduced into thinking the world was progressing and was growing more prosperous. And now we've been awakened to the startling reality. But if you read book 2 and Lewis's essay on living in the atomic age, you realize that Lewis is doing what Lewis does best, plagiarizing medieval authors like Boethius. Yeah, so everyone knew it. Chaucer knew it. Dante knew it. Everyone loved this passage. I think it's because it was so visual, and it kind of gave them a chance to think theologically about the geometry which they had inflicted on them as schoolboys.
Wealth, high office, power, glory, and pleasure. Lady Philosophy debunks one after another. And then she says something that is strange. She says, while these cannot bring happiness, all of them together can. And what's that about? Where does the argument go from there?
Well, they're good things. You know, it's good to have wealth, and it's good to be respected for what you do. And it's good for good people to have authority. And what's bad is our own psychological addiction to these things, such that we crave them and such that we forget that they're tools, and forget, which we almost always do, and forget that they point to something else which is in which they all participate. So I think what she probably means is that the ultimate thing to which they all participate, what Boethius in a very Platonic way calls the good or the one, is the secret source of the attractiveness of all of these earthly goods, which we misuse and misperceive and allow them to seduce us.
Well, and all of these things are available in God.
Yes, or rather, they all point to something in which they are all partial fragments.
Now, he talks about God. Is that a Platonic philosopher's God, or is Boethius talking about the Christian God?
That's a really interesting point of debate. Some just say that he's a thoroughgoing Platonist. Some say that Lewis says, for example, that it would be unfair to ask Boethius to be a Christian theologian, because what he's trying to do is emphasize what we have in common with this fragile tradition of antiquity, which he had inherited and which was running the risk of complete loss in under Theodoric's reign. So Lewis says, look, just, and again, I think Lewis thinks about himself in these types of terms. What I'm doing right now is not trying to tell you why Virgil is wrong or what Plato got, you know, didn't get right, or how Plato's different from Homer. I'm just trying to emphasize the common inheritance of what we've had and what we're running the risk of losing. So, I mean, that's one possible interpretation, is that it's just really, it's a sort of limitation of genre. It's a particular exercise. It's not Boethius acting as a theologian here, but acting as a philosopher. With that having been said, I think Boethius is probably a lot more philosophizing, a lot more Platonizing than we would feel comfortable with. I mean, in my mind, if I feel like in Christian history, there's a pendulum that swings back and forth. And the two tendencies are to overemphasize the transcendence of God and to overemphasize the immanence of God. So that on one extreme, you have a philosophical God who's kind of like, some sort of, you know, like a fundamental force of physics, right? Some sort of stoic logos, which is the attractive force of the universe. And it's very abstract and it's very transcendent. And it's not very personal. And on the other hand, you have us, and we hang these awful watercolor sketches of like Jesus crying and like comforting a fluffy lamb or something like that. I mean, both of those are, you know, I think pretty awful distortions of Christianity. And Boethius might have been more on the transcendent aspect and, you know, maybe swinging back toward the immanent. But I would say in general, if you have to categorize him, he's on that side of the spectrum, which is probably also why he's particularly valuable for us to read now.
How do the students respond to Boethius' story and his reasoning? Are they satisfied? Are they consoled?
No. And I tell them that Lewis says that if you like Boethius, that's the test of how medieval you are. If you like him, you can be a naturalized citizen of the Middle Ages. You can be a sort of expat from modernity. And so that kind of depresses them, that they don't like Boethius. But no, they don't. They like Book One. They get the sort of, you know, autobiographical elements. And with some help, they like Book Two and they hate the rest of it.
Because they're thinking in modern terms?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Why is this not satisfying to them? I think maybe there's too much contemptus mundi in Boethius. There's too much in Boethius which suggests that this world of flesh and time and history is merely pointing at that which it really wishes that it could be, the underlying spiritual reality. I think that's probably the reason that they don't like it, is that for them, Boethius, well, it's too Platonic. He's too oriented toward this other dimension, which he thinks that we have fleeting glimpses of, momentary, transitory access for. But I think that's probably why the students don't get it, as well as the fact that it's really hard. It's dialectically very, very rigorous. And I think because of the initial sort of consoling exercises of Book One and Book Two, which are very autobiographical and very imagistic, when it starts to turn into this this very rigorous dialectic. And Boethius just sort of builds these long bridges of logical propositions and is very comfortable continuing to build those things. But I think as modern empirical individuals, we tend to grow very suspicious of these long, extensive logical bridges which are not continually resorting to empirical facts to support them.
Could it also be their age?
Yes, I suppose so, yeah. I mean, some of them...
They don't need consolation quite yet.
Some of them have tasted bitterness, but no, not many of them. Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's a truism, right? When you're 19, you don't understand what the liturgical prayer about dwelling in this valley of tears is actually referring to. And so, right, maybe just experientially, they haven't come to a moment in which they need Boethius like a thirsty person needs water.
While Lady Philosophy dismissed the muses who inspired Boethius's laments, throughout the book, she herself is the consummate poetess. Happy was he who could look upon the clear font of the good. Happy who could lose the bonds of heavy earth. That is, there is much more to this life than this life. In order to grow our listening audience for this podcast, let me ask you to do two things. First, if you find the After Dinner Scholar helpful and enjoyable, please tell others about it and encourage them to try it out. Second, if you listen to the podcast through the Wyoming Catholic College website, consider downloading a podcast application in order to subscribe to the podcast and to give it a high rating. Those two things, subscribers and stars, will give the After Dinner Scholar greater visibility to all the users of whichever app you choose, giving more people the opportunity to listen. Thank you very much. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.